but I want to cover some of their main errors of doctrinal heresy and schism, which involve issues of the salvation dogma, false accusations on that point, canonizations, and their completely false and ridiculous views on the decree from the Council of Basel. One of the core doctrinal errors that these heretics and schismatics make is that they will claim that the decree from the Council of Basel, from Session 20, is dogmatic and that we are somehow in violation of it. Now, before I address this, I want to point out that it's ironic that they're accusing us of violating this decree when I was the one who found this decree, and it wasn't quoted by anyone in the traditional movement until I brought it out. I just mentioned that because it's ironic that they think that we actually contradict it, and they're completely wrong. And this is a decree on the necessity to avoid certain people. And this decree declares that no one is bound to avoid communion with anyone in the administration or reception of the sacraments or in any other matter, unless the sentence has been promulgated by a judge, or if it is clear that someone has been excommunicated with such notoriety that it cannot be concealed or excused in any way in law. And so the argument that these schismatics make is that every priest who recognizes Benedict XVI is a notorious heretic, and this says that you must avoid a notorious heretic. Therefore, your position that you can go to some of these priests contradicts that. And the argument's very false for numerous reasons. First of all, the decree is disciplinary. It's not a dogmatic decree, and I'll return to that point. But secondly, the decree itself says that you don't have to avoid the person unless it's been declared by a judge or it's clear that he has incurred a sentence of excommunication with such notoriety that it cannot be concealed or in any way excused in law, end quote. That's an important point which they dismiss. There's a shade of meaning there. Not only does it mention so that it cannot be excused in law, but so that it cannot be concealed in law. And that's the point we make with a lot of these undeclared heretics who regard, for instance, Benedict XVI, for instance, an Eastern Rite priest who might be more conservative, but he's just too wimpy or disinterested to come to the conclusion that Benedict XVI is not the Pope. He would maybe try to conceal his heresy under the argument that you cannot judge the Pope, or you cannot, the Pope must have, St. Peter must have perpetual successors in the primacy, and other Catholic teachings he would cite and misapply, but he would try to conceal his allegiance to Benedict XVI under those arguments. Okay, he cannot excuse it. He's still guilty because he's obstinate and it's not an honest argument, but he is concealing it. He's not as open or as upfront or as notorious as, for instance, an Eastern schismatic who would come right out and say, I don't accept the papacy. I'm not a Roman Catholic. I don't accept Vatican I. He's not even concealing his heresy in law. And so there's an important distinction there. And everyone knows that a priest who would claim to accept all of Catholic teaching is a different in terms of his notoriety from someone who would openly reject it. And so we see that important clarification right in the Decree of Basel, and they dismiss it. And so, in fact, the Decree of Basel favors exactly our position on this issue. It doesn't contradict it. Secondly, the outrageous error they make is they consistently say that this Decree of Basel is a dogmatic decree. And we've even pointed out that this is completely wrong. It's not a dogmatic decree, yet they're so obstinate and of bad will that they insist that it is. We've pointed out that it's a modification of an earlier law at the Council of Constance, a well-known decree called Ad Evitanda Scandala in 1418. And the language of the two decrees is almost exactly the same. And so these clueless schismatics assert that Pope Martin V's decree at the Council of Constance, Ad Evitanda Scandala, was a disciplinary decree, but this decree from Basel was a dogmatic decree. Well, that's patently ridiculous, and I'll give three reasons to totally disprove that. First of all, the decree from the Council of Constance says almost word for word the same thing. The only significant difference concerns the conclusion. The decree from Constance asserted that no one is bound to avoid anyone in the administration or reception of the sacraments or in other matters, unless the censure or sentence had been promulgated specifically by a judge, or someone had notoriously and sacrilegiously struck a cleric. So, to summarize, Constance says you don't have to avoid anyone, okay, under the pretext of an ecclesiastical sentence, unless the sentence has been promulgated expressly by a judge, or a person has struck a cleric. Whereas the Council of Basel said the exact same thing, except it said that you're not bound to avoid anyone unless it's been promulgated by a judge, or if it is clear that he has incurred a sentence of excommunication with such notoriety, as I was saying, that it cannot be concealed or in any way excused in law. That's the only difference. So if, according to these schismatics, the Council of Constance is disciplinary and the Council of Basel is dogmatic, that would mean that the Catholic Church has issued two different and conflicting teachings on a matter that is dogmatic. There's no way around that. And that is impossible when, in fact, the notion is heretical. Furthermore, something is determined to be dogmatic or disciplinary based on what? It's determined to be dogmatic or disciplinary based upon the subject matter. Does it deal with a point of faith or morals? Does it deal with a point of a truth of divine revelation? Or does it deal with the governance of the church? Since the language in both of these decrees is the same, and the degree of authority would be the same because they both emanated from councils and sessions of those councils which were approved by a pope, the language or the degree of authority is not a question here. The only question comes down to the subject matter. What is it talking about? Not the conclusion it gives, but what is it dealing with? That determines whether it's dogmatic or disciplinary. Well, the subject matter in both is exactly the same, and I'm going to quote them both to prove that. I'll quote the beginning of both. Pope Martin V, Adi Vitanda Scandala, quote, "To avoid scandals and many dangers and relieve timorous consciences, we mercifully grant to all of Christ's faithful that henceforth no one shall be bound to abstain from communion with anyone in the administration or reception of the sacraments, or in any other religious or non-religious acts whatsoever, nor to avoid anyone, nor to observe any ecclesiastical interdict, on pretext of any ecclesiastical censure or sentence, globally promulgated whether by the law or by an individual." Okay? So that's the subject matter of Adi Vitanda Scandala. Whether you're bound and how you're bound to avoid communion with anyone in the administration or reception of the sacraments or in any other religious or non-religious acts. That's the subject matter. What's the subject matter of the Decree of Basel? It's exactly the same. Quote, "To avoid scandals and many dangers and to relieve timorous consciences, this synod decrees that nobody shall be obliged to abstain from communion with anyone in the administration and reception of the sacraments or in any other sacred or profane matters, or to shun someone or to observe an ecclesiastical interdict on the ground of any ecclesiastical sentence, censure, suspension, or prohibition that has been promulgated." That's the subject matter. It's almost word for word the same. Therefore, it's a fact that if one is dogmatic, the other must be dogmatic. It is utterly illogical and false to assert that one is disciplinary and one is dogmatic. And just because there's a slightly different conclusion, that doesn't affect the truth of this point one bit. Because then someone could say that the church could issue numerous statements on outside the church there is no salvation with slightly different conclusions, and conclude that, oh, even though they had all the language for infallibility, you know, the ones that have certain conclusions were disciplinary, but the ones that have other conclusions were dogmatic. Obviously, that's illogical nonsense. If it's a solemn decree on the subject matter of outside the church there is no salvation, it is a dogmatic decree. And the church could never issue two different conclusions, even if there were slight differences, on something of that subject matter. And so the subject matter of both of these is the same. They're either both dogmatic or they're both disciplinary. They're obviously both disciplinary because the subject matter is disciplinary. It's dealing with whether you're bound to abstain from communion with people in the administration, etc., of the sacraments, and in other acts. Okay, so it involves a lot of things here. It's a disciplinary decree dealing with the governance of the church. It's not a strictly dogmatic teaching. And so this is an important point to blow away the false arguments and the false accusations of these schismatics. Not only does our position not conflict with the decree, but we were completely right when we said it's disciplinary. And these individuals have repeated this lie and this falsehood obstinately in the face of the evidence and asserted this over and over again, and actually deceived certain people who I guess don't understand these things very much or aren't looking at our responses. And so I think it's a big blow, because even one of them admitted that if we can show that the Council of Basel is in fact a disciplinary decree, that would prove he's a schismatic. Well, we've proven that many times. One further point which again illustrates that the decree from Basel is disciplinary, not dogmatic, is the fact that it deals not only with how one is bound or not bound to avoid someone in the administration and reception of the sacraments, but also in any other religious or non-religious acts whatsoever. If it were dogmatic, it would mean that you would absolutely, and in every case, have to avoid a notorious heretic or someone they would deem to fit the category of a notorious heretic in all non-religious acts, such as if you lived with a heretic, your mom might be a heretic, you couldn't communicate with her in any of the non-religious acts of the house, such as sharing the washing machine. But obviously that's absurd, and that's not a dogmatic teaching of the church. It was a disciplinary decree for that specific time period when individuals who were so notoriously excommunicated could be shunned by all the faithful because of the way that the church had authority, which was backed up by the secular arm. And this refutation might even prompt them to change their religion again. They're constantly updating their religion. That's another point I wanted to mention, that a hallmark of these schismatics is that you get an email from them every so often, or it's forwarded to you, that they've changed their religion, they've realized that they were in heresy, they've realized that they were in schism, they've issued new abjurations, and this is another proof not only that they're not Catholic, but in addition that they're driven directly by the devil. They have no conviction, and they don't seem to realize that denying Christ and denying the Catholic faith is a big deal. It's not like, oh, well, I denied the Catholic faith, I'll just abjure and come back into the faith tomorrow. Oh, I made a mistake, I'm outside the church. Well, tomorrow I'll just revise that and come back into the faith. No. In the early church, people who apostatized had to do extraordinary penances and sometimes spend extraordinarily long amounts of time before they could be accepted back into the normal status of the faithful. But these people, they just, you know, they'll acknowledge, yeah, I was a heretic, and then they'll come right back and start to continue to teach as if they know what they're doing. And so as a result, God punishes them more with spiritual blindness. And you would think that a person who has even a certain level of humility would say, wow, I fell flat on my face, I was outside the church, and would maybe then just focus on learning the faith, praying, getting his soul in order. But no, these people, because they don't have any humility at all, think that they're called to go out and teach. And so as a result, God will increase the punishment for them in hell should they continue on their path for misleading others, and he increases their blindness. and they're even more oblivious to how wrong they are and how prideful what they're doing is. In fact, to further illustrate this point, in early June, both Dave L. and Frank came to the conclusion that Pope Leo XIII was a heretical anti-pope, according to them, and that he lost his office because they considered a passage in one of his encyclicals to be manifestly heretical. But then, a few days later, they said, whoops, no, it actually isn't heretical. He is a pope again. So I think that this really illustrates the point I'm making. And immediately after making that egregious blunder, they continued to teach their outrageous views and assert them with as much vigor as ever, as if nothing had happened. Now I'm going to move on to refuting their heresies and false accusations with regard to the dogma outside the church there is no salvation. Now, central to their false theology is their false belief concerning when people become heretics and schismatics. We correctly point out that people who are baptized and accept the essential mysteries of faith become a heretic and or a schismatic when they fulfill the criteria to become a heretic or a schismatic. A heretic is someone who rejects a Catholic teaching. A schismatic is someone who obstinately opposes the hierarchy or separates himself from the hierarchy or the true pope or other Catholics. But in their desire to convince themselves that everyone, for instance, at a church of the Society of St. Pius X is not Catholic, they have come up with a heretical and schismatic view of when people become schismatics. And that's how this whole dispute originated. And so it really started with this guy R.I., who concluded that if you have, for instance, a heretic, whether he's a Protestant heretic, a Greek Orthodox heretic, or a Society of St. Pius X heretic, when that heretic baptizes his child as an infant, everyone agrees that child is a Catholic. That's a matter of Catholic teaching. He's part of the faithful. So the question is, when does that child become non-Catholic? And the answer is that the child receives the Catholic faith at baptism. The child is also made subject to the Roman pontiff at baptism. And the only way to lose membership in the Catholic Church is through heresy, schism, or apostasy. And we've already explained what heresy and schism are. And so we correctly point out that the child, even though he is baptized by a heretic and his parents might be heretics and or are heretics, the child doesn't become a heretic or a schismatic as soon as he hits the age of reason. That's what R.I. ridiculously began to assert. And the reason he held that position, even though it's backed up by no Catholic teaching whatsoever, is because he wanted to convince himself that everybody in a particular household, or everyone in a particular building, or everyone, for instance, at all the traditional chapels, because many of the adults are heretics, all their children, as soon as they hit the age of reason, are heretics. And so his argument essentially consisted of, well, if they're not heretics, then the child baptized to a Protestant when he hits the age of reason is not a heretic. And the answer is that's correct. But notice how the argument rests not on Catholic teaching, but purely on emotion. Because we are logical and truthful and adhere to Catholic teaching, we can see that a heretic is a heretic, whether he's a Protestant heretic, a Society of St. Pius X heretic, or a Greek Orthodox heretic. It doesn't make a difference. The same concepts apply. And so the child of a heretic, no matter what the heretic is, becomes a heretic when that child fulfills the requirements to become a heretic, not because his parent is a heretic. And so as soon as the child would embrace a heresy or reject Catholic teaching or lose faith in the essential mysteries of the Trinity of the Incarnation or oppose a Catholic teaching or oppose the true pope or the papacy, he would remain Catholic until he did that. That's the teaching of the church. And they call this argument heretical, which is ridiculous, and we actually had an audio debate, which we've posted on our websites in our traditional Catholic audio section with a guy named Aaron, and we could see that his position is a tower of sand, and it was refuted, and he knows nothing of what he's talking about. And this, of course, is true because there were countless heretics in church history. Heretics in the early church who might have embraced Nestorianism, okay? But they didn't share with their children all the ins and outs of Nestorian view of Christ. The parents were certainly heretics, but if their child was baptized, okay, and reached the age of reason and didn't understand or wasn't explained the Nestorian heresy, the child wouldn't become a heretic just because his dad was. And so because a proper understanding of this issue destroys their false theology, they have accused that correct understanding of being heretical. And they tried to prove that it's heretical by first arguing that Pope Boniface VIII defined that every human creature must be subject to the Roman pontiff, and therefore someone who hits the age of reason, who doesn't acknowledge the true pope, or doesn't know of the office of the papacy, is not subject to the Roman pontiff. Well, that's easily refuted by the fact that the subjection to the Roman pontiff comes with baptism, okay? If every human creature needed to know the Roman pontiff positively to be subject to him, then infants couldn't be saved. So the essential subjection of the Roman pontiff comes with baptism. Over and above that, for someone above the age of reason, he can't reject the Roman pontiff. It doesn't mean that every single person above reason must know the true Roman pontiff. It's also proven not only by the case of St. Vincent Ferrer and other saints who recognized antipopes for a certain period of time and thus did not regard the true Roman pontiff as the pope, but also by missionaries who baptized certain pagans and could only had time to explain to them the certain mysteries of faith. The Catholic faith, if defined in terms of its simplest components, is the Trinity and the Incarnation. That's why the Athanasian Creed says that very thing. That's why every Holy Office decree, which would address the issue of what does a person need to positively know without exception, by a necessity of means, to be baptized and saved, it's the Trinity and the Incarnation. It's nothing else. Those are the two essential mysteries of Catholic faith. You cannot reject the Roman Pontiff or any dogma and be saved, but you don't have to positively know every other dogma to be saved. And so by their first argument to try to prove our position false was that, well, every human creature must be subject to the Roman Pontiff. And in fact, this Frank heretic concluded that St. Vincent Ferrer was a schismatic because he wasn't subject to the Roman Pontiff. And according to him, subjection to the Roman Pontiff meant that you had to know the Roman Pontiff. Therefore, logically, St. Vincent Ferrer would have been outside the church when he was following an antipope. And Frank actually took this position until we refuted it in that debate with Aaron, and pointed out that, no, that's not what subjection to the Roman Pontiff means. We quoted numerous things, and also we pointed out how papal authority, the popes who prepared and canonized St. Vincent Ferrer, approved his mission while he was under the antipope. So obviously he wasn't outside the church at that time. Well, after we refuted that for them, they modified their position again. Maybe they would have considered that, well, actually, you know what, these guys are right. They do understand what they're talking about on subjection of the Roman Pontiff, but no. In their blind pride, they just shift their position a little bit more. And I wanted to read what this heretic, Frank, this is an email he wrote to me on February 9th, 2008. And I had been trying to tell him that, no, your understanding of this issue is wrong. Subjection to the Roman Pontiff does not require that every single person above reason know the Roman Pontiff. Okay, and therefore someone like St. Vincent Ferrer wouldn't be a schismatic. And here's what he said when he was convinced of this. Quote, "You have backed yourself into a logical corner and you know it. Your true master has been revealed. You are of your father, the devil. You serve Satan, the father of lies. What I am trying to get Peter to see is that his salvation beliefs are wrong. There are four absolutely necessary minimum requirements for salvation: water baptism, belief in the Trinity, belief in the Incarnation, subjection to the Roman Pontiff, which for post-age of reason person includes obeying papal teachings and the self-professed allegiance to the Bishop of Rome and the Catholic Church he heads." End quote. So you can see he claims to be totally convinced. He's calling me the devil of the devil, saying that I serve Satan, because I'm correctly pointing out to him that, no, your understanding of subjection to the Roman Pontiff is completely wrong, you blind and obstinate heretic. You're of the devil. You're of the father of lies, not me. And, of course, about exactly 1 year later, I write to him and I say, do you still hold that false position? And he writes back and he acknowledges that he changed his position. This is from the same heretic named Frank, March 26, 2009. Quote, yes, I happily admit to my previous error that I used to believe that St. Vincent Ferrer was a schismatic and following an anti-pope. Well, that in itself is a lie. He's not happily admitting it to me because he didn't write to me and say, well, yeah, I tried to mislead you on that. I tried to convince you of something that was wrong. No, he only admitted it when I questioned him. So we see his phoniness. Okay, so he, by his own words, proves that he was not a Catholic, proves that he doesn't have a clue about the dogma outside the Church's no salvation or subjection to Roman Pontiff. And this is the guy, this guy, Dave L., was basically attracted to, like a demon being attracted to another demon. And it's not surprising, considering what we've been documenting about Dave. And so you would think that their acknowledgement that they were completely wrong about St. Vincent Ferrer and the strict meaning of subjection to the Roman Pontiff might cause them to say, well, you know what, they are right. But no, they continue to assert that our understanding is heretical. They just shift their assertion a little bit. Now, according to them, subjection to the Roman Pontiff doesn't require every human creature to know the Roman Pontiff, but it requires every human creature above reason to know the office of the papacy. So St. Vincent Ferrer is excused. And in actually explaining this heretical understanding of subjection to the Roman Pontiff, they employ ridiculous arguments. Before I get to that, I want to mention that almost everything that's true that these guys mention is just basically taken and repackaged from our material. So, in trying to explain how St. Vincent Ferrer could not have acknowledged the Roman Pontiff when they think that subjection to the Roman Pontiff requires an acknowledgement of the true Pope or at least an office of the papacy, they apply the teaching on invincible ignorance to St. Vincent Ferrer. They quote Pope Pius IX in his document Singulari Quadam, which is addressed in our book and which we've discussed many times, where he says that, quote, for it must be held that there's no salvation outside the Church, that it's the only ark of salvation. On the other hand, they who labor in ignorance of the true religion, if this ignorance is invincible, are not stained by any guilt in this matter in the eyes of God. End quote. Now, the correct understanding of this document, which is not infallible, is that he's simply saying that a pagan on the island, someone who has not heard of the gospel, is not guilty of the sin of infidelity or rejecting the gospel, as the Church has taught. The pagan on the island is not going to be damned for rejecting the gospel if he hasn't heard it. He will be damned for his dishonesty, his sins of the flesh, his lack of charity where he is. He's not held guilty in that matter of infidelity, not necessarily in other matters, and he cannot be saved ignorant of the faith. But these heretical, clueless schismatics try to apply this teaching, okay, to St. Vincent Ferrer, a Catholic, regarding his error about who the true Pope was. Well, this is actually heretical, because if you look carefully at what Pius IX says, he's speaking of those who labor in ignorance of the true religion. So according to them, St. Vincent Ferrer was a Catholic, but also ignorant of the Catholic religion. So according to them, one can be inside the Church while being part of a different religion, or not knowing the Catholic religion. And that, of course, is heretical. And it shows that he's not talking about Catholics, okay, let alone priests who may be ignorant of a certain aspect of what's going on. He's talking about people who haven't heard of the gospel at all. And that's further proven by Quanto Confessio Mor, which is a similar document of Pius IX, where he's talking about the same thing, bringing those who are ignorant into the Church. He says that they can be saved by the operating power of divine light and grace. And that phrase, the operating power of divine light and grace, is a reference to receiving the gospel among those who had not received it before. For instance, you were heretofore darkness, but now light in the Lord. Okay, referring to the transition from paganism to the light of the gospel. It's not talking about, okay, anything else. And Pius IX is saying that, yes, these people, if they are of goodwill, God will bring them into the gospel by the operating power of his divine light and grace. which shows that Pius IX is talking about people who have never heard of the gospel. He's not talking about someone like St. Vincent Ferrer. And so this is just another heretical perversion of Catholic teaching, another error that comes and emanates from their misunderstanding, their failure to understand Catholic teaching. And it's ironic, actually, that these guys think they understand the dogma. Number one, when this guy, Dave, obviously believes in nothing, and if he ever believed in the dogma, he wouldn't have gone back to the Vatican II Church after seeing that they reject the dogma. And this Frank, I distinctly recall the first conversation I had with him, I had to struggle to convince him that Pius IX was not teaching that people can be saved in other religions. He was trying to find every way around it possible. Okay, so I sensed a lot of bad will. I distinctly remember this in the very first conversation I had with this guy. And it was through our material that he became a Sede Vacantist, etc. But since he claimed agreement, I had to say, well, he agrees. But I always sensed a lot of bad will and a failure to submit to Catholic truth. And so it's ironic that this guy now thinks he believes in the dogma, and as we can see, he doesn't. And another aspect of this is, because I truly believe in Catholic teaching, I can understand that subjection to the Roman Pontiff has no exceptions. That's why it means, it doesn't mean that everyone must know the Roman Pontiff. It means that everyone must be baptized, and by virtue of their baptism, they are subject to the jurisdiction of the Church, and the Roman Pontiff has the jurisdiction of the Church. And it means, above reason, you cannot reject the true Pope or any Catholic teaching. But because they don't really believe that, they have to insert exceptions to their false view of what subjection to the Roman Pontiff means. So we further see how their view of subjection to the Roman Pontiff is crumbling and is false. It's leading them to errors on St. Vincent Ferrer. It's causing them to have to apply invincible ignorance to this issue. In fact, in explaining their false view of this, they say there was, quote, no way for a layman or St. Vincent Ferrer to know who the real Pope was. Well, that would mean it's impossible. But the Council of Trent condemned the idea that God commands impossibilities. Therefore, if according to them, it's the divine rule and the divine law that every person above reason must know the Roman Pontiff, you are asserting that God has commanded impossibilities. And that, again, is heretical. Whereas the truth is that God has commanded every person to be baptized and not to reject any Catholic teaching or not to obstinately separate himself from the hierarchy. And so, as they're refuted again and again, you'd think that maybe they'd abandon their position on this issue and withdraw their false accusations against us, such as their lie. They say that we believe that Protestants can be saved. Not true. That's a lie. We correctly understand when a person becomes a Protestant. He doesn't become a Protestant just because his dad is a Protestant. He becomes a Protestant when he becomes a Protestant. And so they misrepresent our position on that and distort it. And it's blown away by a number of Catholic teachings, which I quickly want to cite. Pope Pius IX, Quartus Supra, number 12. For the Catholic Church has always regarded as schismatic those who obstinately oppose the lawful prelates of the Church. St. Thomas Aquinas, Summa 2.2, Question 39, Article 2. Accordingly, schismatics, properly so called, are those who willfully and intentionally separate themselves from the unity of the Church. Wherefore, schismatics are those who refuse to submit to the Roman Pontiff and to hold communion with those members of the Church who acknowledge his supremacy. And this quote I'm going to give from Pope Clement VI obliterates their whole heretical position. Pope Clement VI, Super Quibustam, Denzinger 570b. We ask whether you and the Church of the Armenians, which is obedient to you, believe that all those who in baptism have received the same Catholic faith and afterwards have withdrawn or will withdraw in the future from the communion of this same Roman Church, which one alone is Catholic, are schismatic and heretical, if they remain obstinately separated from the faith of this Roman Church, end quote. So in this decree of Clement VI, which they'd have to call heretical, he correctly declares that all people baptized, okay, who as infants receive the Catholic faith, and they become schismatic or heretical, what? If they remain obstinately separated from the faith of this Roman Church, end quote. Exactly our position. Not what the apostate RI says when they hit the age of reason not because their parent is, but because if they remain obstinately separated from the faith of this Roman Church. And this has to be understood with care, because you have the baptism of desire apostates who, failing or neglecting to understand what we're talking about here, will try to say that only those who reject the Catholic Church can't be saved. No, that's not what we're saying. If you've never entered the church, you are lost, even if you've never heard of the church. But for those who are in the church by virtue of their baptism as an infant and subjection of the Roman Pontiff as an infant, they don't leave the church. They're already in it until they obstinately separate from the faith of this Roman Church. Furthermore, and this brings me to refuting another one of their damnable lies, they say that we believe that someone who believes justification by faith alone can be saved. Man, we don't believe that, okay? We've been falsely accused of that, among many other things. Even if someone hasn't, let's say you have a Protestant heretic who baptizes his child and he reaches the age of reason, okay, and that child believes in the essential mysteries of Catholic faith, the Trinity and the Incarnation. If that child imbibes the heresy of justification by faith alone, even if he hasn't seen the Catholic teaching which condemns that heresy, that child loses the faith. And the reason for that is that justification by faith alone is incompatible with a true faith in God, who is a rewarder and a punisher. Someone knows that if the notion that someone can just believe in Jesus and do whatever they want and be saved is incompatible with essential faith in God, who is a rewarder and a punisher. He's going to punish for evil actions. And so they would lose the faith even if they're not obstinately opposed to something such as the Council of Trent. And so again, this is another facet of this that they don't understand. And so in order to try to refute our correct position, which they can't prove it's wrong at all. In fact, we've proven many times their position's wrong. They will resort to emotional rhetoric. They will ask a question like this, and they actually pose this question to me as if it's a stumper. Quote, if a child is baptized Lutheran, never hears of the Catholic Church, but thinks that Martin Luther is a hero who fought for the true faith of Jesus Christ, and then he dies the day after he attains the use of reason, can he be saved? Why or why not? End quote. So that's the question. Before I answer it and refute their false implication and their heretical understanding, I will mention that this is a clear example of what I was talking about, impressionistic or emotional rhetoric, where they can't refute the teaching, and so they have to create the impression that something's being said about Protestants or something's being said about Martin Luther. And this only deceives people who are dishonest and of bad will. Because a person of truth says, what exactly is being said about Martin Luther and Protestants? Secondly, they obviously think an affirmative answer to this question is heretical. They obviously think it's heretical to hold that such a child could be saved, because there would be no reason for them to ask it as if it's a stumper. Now, in answering the question, I have to point out that they couldn't even phrase the question correctly, because they say, if a child is baptized Lutheran, never hears of the Catholic Church, but thinks that Martin Luther is a hero, well, that's not even a correct articulation of the question, which reveals their inability to understand the issue, or their unwillingness to understand the issue. A child is baptized as an infant, and that's what we're discussing. He's not baptized Lutheran, he's baptized Catholic. That's de fide, even if he is baptized by a Lutheran. So you can't even phrase your question correctly because you're a blind heretic. The question should be, is a child who is baptized a Catholic as an infant by Lutherans, but thinks that Martin Luther is a hero who fought for the true faith of Jesus Christ and then dies after he attains the use of reason saved, why or why not? So you have a child who is baptized as an infant, reaches the age of reason, believes in the Trinity and the Incarnation, the essential mysteries of Catholic faith, and is told that Martin Luther, fought for the true faith of Jesus Christ, and thus considers Martin Luther his hero, and then dies. Well, first of all, for someone to consider another person his hero presupposes a familiarity with the life of that person. For obviously someone does not consider another person his hero except for a reason. Therefore, if someone considers Martin Luther his hero because he rejected Catholic teaching, was excommunicated by the Catholic Church, rebelled against the Catholic Church, taught justification by faith alone or scripture alone, etc., anything that the historical, notorious Martin Luther did, then of course he would be a heretic for considering him his hero. But they posit a child who is told that Martin Luther, fought for the true faith of Jesus Christ, but knows nothing about what the historical notorious Martin Luther did, except that he, quote, fought for the true faith of Jesus Christ. This person therefore knows nothing about the historical notorious Martin Luther. For him, the Martin Luther he knows has no connection to the historical Martin Luther. He wouldn't know him from a man named Luther Martin, who, quote, fought for the true faith of Jesus Christ, or from his cousin's friend, or if he had a distant relative who could have been named Martin Luther. So the answer to your bad-willed question, which is founded purely on emotional and impressionistic rhetoric, is that if he doesn't know anything about the life of Martin Luther or his heresies, then he certainly could be saved. In fact, it's a dogmatic fact that he could be saved. For there could have been a Martin Luther in the past who did fight for the true faith of Jesus Christ. Martin was a common name. The name Martin Luther is not inherently evil. It's when it's associated with the heretical actions of the notorious Martin Luther that to honor him becomes heretical. That should be obvious to a person of good will, which you people posing this question are not. So your question is stupid, and the fact that you think it's a stumper only serves to further demonstrate your bad will. It proves that you are not a truth seeker, but you simply want to argue with emotions. It's a dogmatic fact that such a person could be saved, because Martin Luther, in fact, wasn't always a heretic. Martin Luther, prior to his apostasy from the Catholic faith, was a Catholic priest. So, if you had this scenario play out in the year, say, 1512, when Martin Luther still professed to be a Catholic priest, and someone baptizes his child, he reached the age of reason, he taught him the mysteries of the Trinity and the Incarnation, and they saw Father Martin Luther walking by, and his dad said, "This is Martin Luther. He fights for the true faith of Jesus Christ. He's our hero." And the child died. That child obviously could be saved. But according to your pathetic argument, it's heretical to think that. And if that can be true in the year 1512, it could be true in the year 1612. It could be true in the year 512, 1712, because divine revelation ended with the death of the last apostle. And so if someone was saved in a certain manner in 1 year since the death of the last apostle, it's possible to be saved in the exact same manner at any time. It's only when a person becomes familiar with the life of the notorious Martin Luther and then agrees with it or supports it that he becomes a heretic, just like Luther was. To further blow away your bad-willed question, I'll give you another example. Nestorius was the arch-heretic of the early church, or an arch-heretic of the early church, just as Luther was an arch-heretic of the later church. Nestorius manifested his heresy in the year 429, but he wasn't officially deposed for over a year. In other words, Nestorius was still officiating as the head of the Catholic Church in Constantinople, and infants were coming to the age of reason under him. Surely some of them were told, "Nestorius is our leader, our hero." Were those children heretics? Not if they were not told about Nestorius's heresy on the Incarnation. To say otherwise is illogical and completely ridiculous. The name Nestorius is not inherently evil, just like the name Martin Luther is not inherently evil. It's only when someone associates it with their particular heresies and evil actions that supporting someone of that name becomes evil and heretical. So I had to address that question because this was one they posed to us as if we couldn't answer it. And It just further illustrates their blindness and how their position is completely untrue and false. Now I want to move on to another false argument they make. These heretics will cite the document from Pope Pius X, Quam Singulare. This was on the age at which children should approach confession and communion. And the argument is that this document identifies the age of reason as approximately 7. This document teaches that all above that age are bound by the divine law to acknowledge the office of the papacy and or the Roman pontiff and receive confession and communion. And this argument is completely false for a number of reasons. Number one, Pius X's document does not say what they think it does. His document does identify the age of reason as probably around 7 years of age. And here's what he says, quote, he's actually quoting Vasquez, who comments on the words of St. Thomas Aquinas, quote, "When a child has once arrived at the use of reason, he is immediately bound by the divine law, from which not even the church can dispense him." End quote. That's true. The child is bound by the divine law as soon as he reaches the age of reason. If he commits a mortal sin, he will put his soul in the state of damnation. He cannot be excused from the divine law. But what is the divine law? That every person, as soon as he hits the age of reason, must positively know the identity of the true pope? No, as we've established, not everyone in church history was at all times clear on the identity of the true pope. Okay, so is the divine law that every person above the age of reason must know positively the office of the Roman pontiff and the teaching of the church on the successors of St. Peter? No, it isn't. It's that you can't reject that teaching or separate yourself obstinately from the hierarchy. That's why missionaries, as we've pointed out, when they baptize people in quick circumstances, didn't necessarily have time to cover the office of the papacy, but only the Trinity and the Incarnation. It's not of the divine law that everyone above reason must at all times positively know that teaching. And so this is a specious argument, because they're saying that Pius X says you are bound as soon as you hit the age of reason to obey the divine law. That's right. But the divine law does not teach what you think it does, as we've pointed out, and as your admissions on these points even prove. That's one point. The second point is that he goes on in this document to say, "But when a child is doing wrong," and Pius X is quoting St. Antoninus, "that is, of committing a mortal sin, then he is bound by the precept of confession and consequently of communion. The age of discretion, both for confession and for communion, is the time when a child begins to reason. That is about the 7th year, more or less." End quote. So their argument is, well, it goes on to say, "From that time on begins the obligation of fulfilling the precept of both confession and communion." End quote. So they're saying, well, see, everyone's bound at the age of 7, about to receive confession and communion. Well, first of all, anyone who can think carefully should be able to see that their argument is completely ridiculous, because their children, and some of these schismatics do have children, they don't receive confession and communion because they don't believe that there is anywhere to go to confession and or communion. And so according to their own argument, their children would be outside the church. Secondly, the error here is that we've already cited that Pius X makes a separate reference to the child being bound by the divine law as soon as he hits the age of reason. Okay, we agree. The obligation to know the Roman pontiff in every case, or know the office, is not the divine law. It's that you can't reject him. And then here he goes on to talk about something separate, okay, which is what we're discussing now, the ecclesiastical law, which binds people when they hit the age of reason for confession and communion. That's separate from the divine law reference that he made earlier. And that's true. The ecclesiastical law does bind. But that does not mean that there are not exceptions to that, as everyone agrees, as even these schismatics would have to agree, because their children don't fulfill it. It doesn't bind when you don't have an option. It doesn't bind when you're unaware of that law. There are no exceptions to the divine law, but there are exceptions to fulfilling these ecclesiastical precepts in certain scenarios. So that's the simple refutation of this false argument. Another one which, in their blindness, they thought was just tremendous, but in fact proves nothing.